And now, my friends, we come to the time for questions. Here is a first question. Pay attention, because it is very interesting. And although, of course, it has often been raised, I would give you a few interesting answers. It says, the equality between the two sexes is correct, but what is God's position on this matter? Because it is assumed that we are the ones forging the state of equality of the sexes, whereas God's views, God's positions, are different. That is, God has another will concerning this matter. I would answer, no, not I. I will let John Chrysostom answer on this matter. And you will see that his answer will surprise you. So if you are surprised or hold some unfavorable judgment within you, it will not be against me, but against the Holy Father. And he reasons it out and takes it up. But for this, we will read a somewhat lengthy passage of his. It refers to the matter of marriage, to the matter of the two spouses, and it is from his commentary on the Epistle to the Ephesians of the Apostle Paul. If you wish to note it, it is the 20th homily, chapter 4, paragraph 6. Sorry, it is the 20th homily, paragraphs 4 and 6. I'll send you the reference as well. I'm giving you the citation. So listen to how St. John Chrysostom answers. He says, a second principle is a sound one. You see, when we say principle, the word archy also means head, the source that rules. The word, the term arc, in philosophy means something that cannot be made to vanish, as when we speak of the first principle of the good or the first principle of evil. It is eternal. It does not begin and does not end. This, in philosophy, is called arc. A first principle. Man, God is a first principle for dualism, for Gnosticism, and the devil, too, is a first principle. That is, that the devil was not created by God, but is self-existent and therefore constitutes a first principle. I am explaining the word, the term arc, so that you understand what it means. Now, when we say that within the household we have one arc, one beginning, what does arc mean here? One head. How many of these heads are there? Can these principles be more than one? Here St. John Chrysostom says that the first principle, the principle in the true sense, is the man. He is the head, the first principle, and the woman, he says, is a second principle. The woman is a second principle. But of course, someone might object. Then we have two principles that will do nothing but gather momentum and butt heads against each other. But it is not so, because since she is a second beginning, the second must be below, beneath the first. And he says here, let her not then demand equality of rank. Because, he says, consequently, as a second beginning, she must not demand equality of rank. Since she is a second beginning, she must not demand equality of rank. According to John Chrysostom, he continues, for she is under the head, because she is beneath the head, which constitutes the principal beginning. Nor let him, that is, the man, despise her as one who is subordinate. And should the man indeed, precisely because he is the head, despise the subordinate woman? No, for she is his body, and if the head despises the body, it too perishes with it. Because she is the body, and if now the head, he says, despises the body, then it too will be destroyed. Suppose I have my head and my body. If the head scorns the body, does not nourish it, does not care for it, the body will be destroyed. But when the body is destroyed, is not the head destroyed along with it? This is a very correct observation. Moreover, the image of the body, to portray the man and the woman, belongs to the Apostle Paul, and it is exceedingly apt, just as the image to portray Christ and the church. Christ is the head. The church is the body, and this is the prototype image by virtue of which the family is created, where Christ, forgive me, the man, is an image of Christ, and the woman an image of the church. But as a counterweight to obedience, he introduces love. You, O woman, must obey the man. But you must also, in a corresponding manner to this love, to this obedience that is asked of the woman, you must introduce love. She will submit, you will love, as the head and the body, just as it is with the head and the body. The one cannot turn against the other. The one provides for service the hands, the feet, all the other members, while the others provide for it, having all sensation gathered in itself. That is, what does the body provide now? The hands, the feet, all those members. And so the woman too provides everything to the head. Nothing is better than this union. In this relationship, there is nothing better than wedlock. That is, if the husband holds this stance, and the wife holds this stance. And how could there be love when there is fear? Does not the Apostle Paul say, "And let the woman fear her husband"? It is that thing which the feminists of Larissa, when this eruption of feminism began here in Larissa a very few years ago, said when civil marriage came in, the feminists of Larissa said, "It was published, which is why I am telling you this." They said, "At last we will not have to go to church to hear that foolish and dreadful thing, and let the woman fear her husband." Listen, with civil marriage we will have no need to go to church to be married, to hear, we women, this dreadful thing, and indeed some chanters, because it is chanters who read the epistle, and in that epistle reading it is written, say, "And let the woman respect her husband." No, whatever the word says, whatever the Holy Spirit recorded, "And let the wife fear her husband." So, what does St. John Chrysostom say here? He asks, if fear is present, if you are living in fear, how could love ever possibly grow? Indeed, St. John Chrysostom says the very opposite. It is precisely when there is fear that love is fulfilled. Because if there is no fear, love is not fulfilled. We will see this further on. For she who fears also loves. Because she who fears, she also loves. For if she does not fear, she will not love. She will begin to move outward in her life, and will say, "And who do I have to reckon with?" And once she says, "Who do I have to reckon with?" simply because she says, "Who do I have to reckon with?" she shows that she no longer loves. The wife who loves fears him as her head and loves him as a member of her own body. This is a beautiful point. She fears the head because she loves him, but she also loves him as a member of herself. Because the head is not something foreign to the body. The head, too, is a member of the whole body. That is exactly what I told you. For this reason, he says, God subjected the one and set the other over her so that there might be peace. This is why God, most beautifully and most harmoniously, subjected the wife, placing her under the authority of the husband, and set the husband over her, placing him as the authority, so that peace might exist. So then, for there to be peace, there must not be equality of rank. For there to be peace, there must not be equality of rank. Listen to why, because I have something further down that I want to stress to you. So please pay attention. For where there is equality of rank, peace can never come about. Where there is equality of rank, peace does not exist. No better portrait of the soul could be drawn than this. Where there is equality of rank, there is no peace, because the husband will say one thing and the wife will say another, each one pulling their own way. That is what it comes to. But then there is no peace. When the husband says one thing and the wife says, "Yes, of course," then there is peace. As Chrysostom says, a household cannot be run as a democracy, with everyone ruling. Rather, there must of necessity be one governing authority, a home that runs on democratic principles, where the father and the mother say to the children, "Children, where shall we go for our outing?" "Dad, let's go to Olympus." "No, let's go to Kisavos." "Dad, let's go to the disco." "No, let's go to the monastery." "Well then, tell me, what is going to happen?" This is why, he says, a home that runs on democratic principles cannot stand. I will say the phrase again, nor when a household is run as a democracy can it go well, nor can everyone be a ruler within the home. There must of necessity be one governing authority. We will go there. The husband may perhaps express the wishes of the members of the household, but we are not going to sit and put everything to a vote. Just now, I was saying to you, "Children, what do you want me to do? Do you want me to show you a presentation? Do you want me to put on some music? Or do you want me to give you a talk?" What would happen in here? What would happen in here? This does not mean that we should not express ourselves, that we should not feel the need to say what the majority wish in given situations. I remember once I had gone to Ampelona's to hear confessions. It was Great Lent, and Pascha was drawing near. The headmaster made a mistake and said to me, "Please, come on Saturday, so we can continue the confessions." So I went on the Saturday, but when I arrived, I saw that the children were getting ready for an excursion. "Father, I am terribly sorry. It slipped my mind that on Saturday we would be having the excursion." "Now what shall we do?" I said. "Listen, it is very simple, very simple. I will come along with you, and I will hear confessions at the place of the excursion. We had gone to St. Thomas outside Ampelonas. As you know, a little church. The children were playing happily, and those who wanted to confess did so. Only the final year of the Lyceum had stayed. That is, the sixth form of the gymnasium. As we had the gymnasium back then, and the children came and confessed. Can you imagine if I had said, "Ah, excuse me, if you make a mistake about this, it is not my fault, because I came." And if we now have to say which is the higher thing is confession compared to the excursion. Yes, it is higher, but it would have been psychologically tone deaf. It is higher, but tone deaf, because if I had said to the children, "Ah, children, over here, for confession," the children would have grumbled. So you see, the one who is the head must sense what the other person loves, what he wants, but he is not going to sit and hold votes and create a democracy within the home, because I will say it once more, a third time. A home that has democracy goes to ruin, nor when a household is run as a democracy, nor when everyone rules, nor can everyone be the master. Rather, there must of necessity be one governing authority. Now, if you take this image, I told you to pay attention. Here, pay attention. If you take this small image, which is called the home, the family, and you enlarge it, you make something else. This something else that we make. If we enlarge it, you understand. You understand. You understand what harm a wrongly understood democracy does within a state. Look, we were saying, just now as we were coming, we were discussing in the car, that some schools are in danger of losing the second semester as well. Higher schools, colleges, and universities. They are in danger of losing the second semester, too, because the schools have been occupied by sit-ins. And this is in the name of a democracy. Gentlemen, one might say, how many of you are there who do not want to have classes, or who are demanding? I do not know what you are demanding. 5, 10, 50. But the other 500 want to have classes. Why, then, should the large number be ignored in order to keep the small number in their opinion? If this is called democracy, if this is called democracy, and all of this in the name of democracy. So you understand that when a people is immature, lacking the sensitivity to perceive and respect the person next to them, or even themselves, democracy ends up in something very bad. We are living it lately, these past years. We see this ourselves. I do not want to say anything other than this. Democracy is wonderful, but in the sense that there will be one governing authority. The others will give their opinion, but that does not mean you can impose it on me. I can certainly say to you, children, give me your opinion on something. Write your opinion down for me and let it be heard. I should be obliged to listen to your opinion. But beyond your opinion, it may not be correct. What does a person have? Not the Greek, the human being. I have said my opinion. If I was given the chance to say my opinion, does that mean my opinion must also prevail? Why, sir? That is called authoritarianism. Because, quite simply, you said your opinion. Now, it may not be correct. It may not be advantageous, you said it, and so it is. And whether it comes on a large scale or a small scale, things must be heard in this way. In the brotherhood, I will ask children, fathers, what would you have to say about this matter? Why should I now be obliged to act on what may even be contradictory opinions? Or suppose someone said something I would not agree with. That should not be done. It is not advantageous. It is not advantageous for me to do this. And suppose I do not do what this someone said. Is he now going to pull a long face and get angry? For what reason? You said your opinion. That is the end of it. Or in our friendships, in our collegial relations, we say our opinion. Have you noticed that some people say their opinion and insist, come what may, that you must do it this way? And you see something else that is terrible. The other person waits to say to you, what did you do about the thing I told you? You told me. Thank you very much. What I do from there on is my own affair. Why must you drive yourself like a wedge into my own life and my decision? You told me, it is your opinion. Thank you, I see that it does not serve me. I will not do it. It serves me only halfway. So you understand how things really stand. For a family to survive, there must be a single governing authority, and that authority is the father. The mother is the second principle. So the children and the mother all obey under the father. But when the father loves, here is the crucial point. It is exactly like a machine made of iron parts. If you set it running, it bangs and clatters and disturbs four neighborhoods with the racket it makes. Put a little grease on its iron parts, please, and you will see it no longer bangs. It runs like a clock. Well, that grease is love, and in those opposing forces within the home when there is love, but still a single authority. Love is present too. Then everything afterward goes very well. That is what John Chrysostom means to say. And he continues, and these things everywhere hold for bodily matters always follow. Notice this, that is, he says these things apply to every area of life, to bodily matters, that is, to material things. For if you make her holy and blameless, everything follows. If you arrange things this way, everything follows beautifully. Seek the things of God, and the human things follow with great ease. Seek to have what God wants, and all the other things, the human things. Go very well. Order your wife, says John Chrysostom, and in this way the household is held together. Set your wife right, order her in her household, for she does not know how to move. And then the home is held together very well, because in reality, children, the husband shapes the wife. And of course, the prudent and sensible wife, in her turn, and in her own way, also shapes the husband. She is a second principle, having authority herself and much equality of honor. The wife is a second principle, and she has as her head, whom? The husband. And then in this very thing there is also equality of honor. But still, the husband has something more, with equality of honor. Yet, the husband has something more. This is the greatest salvation of the household. This is the salvation of the home. If these principles are applied within the home, this is the salvation of the home. There is no need, children, for you to run and check whether these things are truly so or not. You will see the modern home driven and carried about by all sorts of theories and notions. And today, the home is no longer one head and one body, but simply two heads, a Lernaean hydra, and the children too become heads, and the home becomes a scattered chaos. And how did this happen? When the wife tells you she will keep her own surname, she will have her own salary, her own money. You will not put my money into the common fund. My money, your money, do you hear? And the children take the example and say, I work now too, this is my money. And then what do you say? The home becomes a scattered chaos, a hotel where we live together, only by convention. From the results, one can see whether these words of John Chrysostom are right or not. Judge it, and you will see, if you are impartial, you will see where the truth lies. That is all. Children. This question was a bit long, but also exceedingly interesting. Interesting, as you saw. Let us come to another question. That is, I want to tell you that we must reconsider very many of the things that are served to us in our age. Things that are very little evangelical. That is, they are not evangelical at all. We must take great care. Here is another question. Is it necessary for us to believe in some God? Is it not enough to be honest, moral, truthful, and so on, without expecting any reward? Yes, indeed. Now here, my friends, the question is, of course, very interesting, as you can see, and the answers would go something like this. Faith and virtue certainly do not presuppose reward. Faith in God, of course, makes virtue something dependent. One will say, I believe in God. This means I have dependence upon God. If I practice virtue, which is the command of faith, it means that virtue, undeniably, is dependent upon God. But as dependent, not that I would be seeking a reward. I simply do it this way, because otherwise we would undeniably have the ancestral sin again, a repetition, and the ancestral sin is repeated continually, which is nothing other than the autonomy, even of virtue, not only of my opinion, but of virtue itself. I want to be this. I want to be a lover of mankind. To love people, because that is what I like. That is what suits me. That is what fits me. Not because God says so. This is something very terrible. You see how many reissues we have of the ancestral sin. Nevertheless, our relationship with God, children, is not a relationship of faith. For faith is the first approach. It is a relationship of love, because God is not a person with whom I will have a relationship of mere recognition. That is what faith means. It is a relationship of recognition. I recognize that you are God, but in the same way an employee also recognizes his superior, yet there may be no good relationship between them at all. Yes, he is my superior. But as you see, Christianity does not want only this relationship of faith to exist. The relationship of faith is, as we said, recognition, but it is a relationship of love, and this is seen very clearly. That is, I do what God wants. not so that he will reward my virtue, but because I love God. So that you may see this, I will tell it to you with an example. Why do you love your parents, children? Because they feed you, they nourish you, and they raise you. Some day they will not be feeding you, but rather you will be feeding them. They will be in an armchair there, and you will be the ones caring for them. Indeed, when I was in the first grade of primary school, my children, they had assigned me a poem at school. In the end, I did not recite it, because there were a multitude of poems, or else the hall could not hold all of us little ones from the first grade. In the end, they brought us out to perform, and my poem I did not recite. In that poem they had given me, it said that I would like to become a teacher. I did not become a teacher, the poem said. No. Then it went on to say that when I became a teacher and so on, I would tell my father to sit in an armchair. And I would say to him, I would say to my aged father now, my father, you have worked much. You no longer have any need to work. Thank you very much. Sit there and rest in that armchair. Tell me, if our relationship were merely a relationship of belief, that is, I acknowledge that you are my father, that you brought me into the world, and that I have a certain independence from you, because you raised me. Now, suppose I have come to depend on my father. My father is sitting in an armchair, helpless. I hold him up so he can rise. Should I throw him out? No, of course not. Should I be expecting some reward, that he leave me his fields, that he give me an inheritance? Absolutely not. Rather, I love him, and that is why I care for him. He is my father. Whether he leaves me property or not makes no difference. He is my father. So then, from this relationship, let us carry things over to God. To love my parents is one thing, and to inherit their property, that is, to have interests at stake, is another thing. So too with God, when I practice virtue, I do not expect a reward. I practice virtue because I love God. I love Christ. And further, my children, a life without God is a life without measure in our relationships, with ourselves, with other people, and with the non-rational creation. Let us not forget this. To say that I will do as I please, practice virtue, without God, means I have lost the measure. The measure, then, is this, that when I keep the measure of belief and of love toward God, that is, the measure of dependence, without expecting any reward, no freely, then I will have the measure by which I can order all my relationships. I say again, with myself, with other people, and with the whole of creation. Today, man, modern man, has emancipated himself from the will of God, and this is the great misfortune. He has emancipated himself, and the result is that he suffers precisely because he abandoned God. That is, modern man expresses himself just like that question, is it necessary for me to have a relationship with God? Can I not practice the virtues, what we call humanism? That is, the love of man, without God, is it necessary? Well, whether it is necessary or not, you will see it in practice. And the practice, my children, is this, that modern man, emancipated from God, in the end does not practice virtue at all, but has become a wolf, a fearsome wolf, both toward his own self, which he destroys, and toward his fellow man. That is why you see today that relationships between people are not what God would want. Because we made this autonomous ethic, we threw God out, we pushed him to the margins, and we live without God. So much, my children, for today on the subject of your questions. And now, my children, on to our questions. Here's another question. Which virtues do you think we ought to have as young Christians? Well, certainly, my children, all the virtues, falling short, in none of them. No one can say that he would make a selection of virtues, the way he might do elsewhere, in other areas and spheres, making his choices. In the realm of belief and of the spiritual life, there is no selecting. There cannot be, there must not be. Consequently, all the virtues are the ones to be acquired in parallel, I said in parallel. We cannot say that we will learn, that we will acquire one virtue, and once we acquire it, let us say that no virtue is ever finished or completed, and then we will begin a second one. Although indeed, for the sake of our striving sometimes, we may place special emphasis on our effort in one area. That is not a bad thing, but it does not mean by this that we should look only at a single virtue. Let me give you another image so you understand this. Suppose you go to school for 6 years to high school. That is, the gymnasium and the lyceum. For 6 years you go just to learn Greek, and when the 6 years are over, you sit down again for another 6 years to learn only mathematics, and so on. Isn't that strange? Well, what does this mean? In parallel, we learn all the subjects. So too in parallel, we cultivate. What does this mean? In parallel, we learn all the subjects. So too, in parallel, we cultivate all the virtues. Nevertheless, since the question was raised, which virtues do you think we ought to have as young Christians? I would answer, they are the four foundational virtues. These are prudence, temperance, justice, and courage, these four. Note that this fourfold ordering of the virtues the ancient Greeks also had, and the fathers took it up as well, and indeed, it is held that from these four foundational virtues, we have the derivatives of all the other virtues. We might say, then, that if we acquire these four virtues, we will have the other virtues as well. In adolescence, of course, the intellect begins to develop. The young person, indeed, after the age of 12 or 13, the adolescent boy and girl take delight in this. He begins to think, not that he did not think before, that he had no intellect, but I mean that he now enjoys his thoughts. The world of his thoughts, he enjoys his mind. He delights in it because he can think, he produces thoughts. This means that the intellect begins to develop. But if now, with the development of the intellect, which is so natural, especially in the adolescent years, he should seek to acquire prudence, which is the adornment of the intellect, then what more could he ask for? What, then, is prudence? Prudence is the virtue of the intellect. Prudence, what we call a prudent person, the one whose intellect is sound. Let me remind you of two very beloved figures who experienced this as young men from the Old Testament, who had prudence. It was Joseph and Daniel. They had a mind, as we say. This man has a mind. You know that prudence, we usually say, is acquired with the years. Although this is certainly not absolute, unfortunately, it is not absolute, though it ought to be. But very many people spend their whole life without ever having acquired prudence. A man reaches 80 years old and never learned what prudence means, even in the most basic things. And yet sometimes one sees a young child, a young person, a young adolescent, and he has a fine mind. He has prudence. You know, there is an ascetic who is called a child elder. Although he was a child, he was 20 years old. He thought like an elder, like an aged man. He had prudence. I told you about Joseph and Daniel, because they were young. Yes, and indeed Daniel, as you know, while he was still very young, perhaps a 20-year-old youth, one day, as he was going along the road, he met a crowd of people who were going to stone that poor woman Susanna. Why? Because, it says, she had been caught in the act. No, forgive me. Not exactly in the act, more or less in the act, of committing sin. Who accused her? Two judges. These judges were staying in her house. That is, they used to try cases in Babylon. This, my children. In Babylon, the Hebrews were in exile, and Daniel too was in exile. Where are you going? He says to them. They tell him this and that, and at once he understood, he grasped, he caught the meaning that something here was not right. Turn back, he tells them. They turned back, he says, to beg that the trial begin again. They were thugs. Those who denounced Susanna, two judges, aged men, quite advanced in years, elders in age, they slandered her because they had demanded this sin from her, and then because the most pure Susanna did not give in. They slander her, saying she is a sinner. He comes out. They bring one of them outside, and Daniel questions him. And Daniel is exceedingly sharp. Tell me, he says to him. For these men were claiming, with some young man, he says, I committed sin in his garden. Tell me, there where you saw her. What tree was it, there where you saw her commit a sin? And he said, it was a mastic tree, fine. Go outside, they call the other one. Tell me, you, under what tree did you see her? And he said, it was a plane tree. At once the contradiction was created, and from there the matter unraveled, my children, and what was established? The slander. What, then, was Daniel? Although he was a mere child, he had prudence. He had a mind. He had a mind. Take note, intelligence is one thing, and prudence is another. You may have intelligence and not have prudence. You may have prudence and not have much intelligence. You may be of ordinary mind, yet have prudence. It is what a folk proverb says. It just came to mind. The children of the prudent cook before they grow hungry. The prudent, that is, someone might say it is morning. We are not hungry, but we will be hungry at noon. Because we are not hungry now, will we not be hungry at noon? Because the food takes time to prepare, we must therefore begin to cook now, so that at noon when we grow hungry, we will have something. the children of the prudent cook before they grow hungry. This is intelligence. This is what prudence means. If you understand, it is that foresight a person can have with his mind. There is no finer adornment, my children, than prudence in a young person. You know, today, both boys and girls put on rings. I've seen girls with 5 rings, not 6, because there are 5 fingers. Yes, 5 rings. 1 ring on each finger. And they put on chains and all sorts of things. They cover themselves in ornaments. Do you know why? They want to cover their inner nakedness, their lack of prudence. The prudent person feels that he already has a treasure, that he already has an adornment. And since he already has that adornment, why would he put on outward ornaments, which are really just a substitute for prudence? Why? But let me come, my children, to the second virtue. After prudence comes self-control, sophrosyne, not in its old sense, but in its modern sense. The word sophrosyne means the one who has his wits about him, the one who is sound of mind. But it also means, and this is not really a new meaning either, it was there among the ancients too, the one who is very careful about the matter of his purity, so that he does not fall into sins of the flesh. This, my children, the sexual instinct, when the young person has mastered it, he has the virtue of self-control. It is the second adornment. Most beautiful indeed. You know that women put on rouge, on blush. Do you know why? You'll tell me. So they look beautiful. No, it is because they do not blush of their own nature. A person blushes by nature, boy or girl, when he feels shame. Shame is an adornment, and only the one who is pure feels shame. The one who has let go of his purity has no reason to feel shame. He becomes shameless. That is why there is a saying that when purity is cast off, shame is cast off along with it. And at the same time, if you will, God. As we said when we were on the topics of Christian anthropology, God placed the feeling of shame in us precisely so that you would guard your purity. Note that in our day it is considered a weakness to blush with shame, as though it were a weakness to have the virtue of purity. No, my children, you who hear the word of God, guard it as your most precious adornment, not just the girls, both the boys and the girls. Guard purity as your most precious treasure. And it is well known that in adolescence, when the sexual instinct also develops, when the young person learns the way to tame it, just as a prudent engineer knows how to arrange the bed of a river so that it does not destroy the plain and the fields. So here too, as prudent ones, you must channel this drive. You must know how to govern it, so that you are not the ones governed, but the ones who govern. So this is the second shining adornment. Then in adolescence, as you know, my children, the bodily powers also begin to develop. Indeed, boys often test themselves and are thrilled when they notice that they are beginning to grow muscular and strong. You see one walk up to another and flex like this to show that he is strong. Or he goes and gives the other a punch, so that the other learns from experience that he has grown stronger, or something else of the kind. So you understand that here, in adolescence, we have a need. A need for what? For which virtue? For courage. But I must tell you that courage is not about throwing punches or kicks. Courage is not in the muscles of the arms. It is in the soul. You can find a person whom you could knock to the ground with a single breath, and yet he is courage. Since I have said this, let me point you to Basil the Great. Basil the Great was very frail in health. In fact, he died at the age of 49, when Modestus, the prefect of his region, what we might call the governor, once threatened him on behalf of the Emperor Julian the Apostate. He said many things to him, threatening to put him to death. And Basil says to him, "It is very simple. The moment you lay a hand on me, I will die. I am so frail that I will die. Just breathe on me and I will fall down. I will die." And yet, if there was anyone who stood up to the fury of the emperor, it was Basil the Great. Note also that Julian the Apostate and Basil the Great had been fellow students in Athens when they were studying. And when Basil the Great spoke those brave words, do you know what he said at the end? How he closed? "Let the emperor hear these things too. Carry them to him exactly as I have spoken them to you. We will remain steadfast in our faith." And yet in body they were weak, but he had a courageous soul. So courage, my children, is mainly a virtue of the soul. But what does courage mean here? Courage means fortitude. It means patient endurance. It means perseverance. The moment you grow hungry, do not say, "Enough, I give it all up." You know, an example of the lack of courage is Esau. When he came back from the hunt, he says to his brother Jacob, "Give me something to eat." Jacob tells him, "I will give you a plate of lentils," because that is what he had cooked. "If you give me your birthright, poor wretch." Esau says to him then, "I am dying of hunger," he says. But would he really die? My children, he could have gone without food another 40 days and he would not have died. But when did he say this? He had eaten that morning. And now, simply because he was not eating in the afternoon somewhere around that hour, he claimed he was about to die. "I am dying of hunger," he says. And am I going to stop and think now about the birthright? And the scripture says he made light of it. He despised his birthright. Do you know what this meant? It meant that Esau would not become the forefather of the Messiah. Jacob became that instead. Do you see what Esau lost? Esau is left outside the garden, my children, outside the people of God. He was driven far off. He became the father of other peoples. It is a terrible thing. And why? Because he did not have the courage to say, "I would rather die of hunger." And he would not even have died of hunger. In a little while, he could have cooked something and eaten. So courage is patient endurance. It is perseverance. It is fortitude. What did the martyrs have, I ask you? They had courage. Where? In the soul. Men, women, the elderly, and children. They all had this courage. Courage is a great virtue. It is a very great one. And if you will, in the days of the Antichrist, we will have great need of the virtue of courage. Finally, we would say, there is also the virtue of justice. When we say justice, we do not, of course, mean only that familiar sense of justice we all know, though that is part of it too. Justice is that virtue, and pay very close attention to this point I am about to tell you. It balances them. It brings the first three virtues into balance: prudence, self-mastery, and courage. What do I mean by balancing? If we had to draw a geometric figure with four sides, we might make a square, or it could turn out to be something else, a rhombus, or some other shape. But here justice sees to it that the four sides of the figure are equal, so it becomes a square. And what does that mean? You know that the square is the perfect figure, the perfect one. We even say it in our own language. That man has a square mind, meaning a perfect mind. And so the perfect man is the one who has these virtues in balance, in equilibrium. That is why the fathers say that the virtue of justice, which they call discernment, enters into the other three virtues. It knows, and it says, from here to here this much, from here to here that much, and so on. And so this last virtue, the last one, preserves the first three and makes a man perfect. It makes him wise. It makes him virtuous. And as I told you, it maintains the virtues he has already acquired. So, my children, if to these four virtues we have spoken of, since you asked which virtues a young person needs to stand firm today, we also add humility. Then we make a great deal of progress. But in order to acquire these virtues, we need two things. One is the spirit of struggle, and the other is the grace of God. If we have only the spirit of struggle and we do not have the grace of God, then we accomplish nothing great. And if we have only the grace of God but we do not have the spirit of struggle, again, we accomplish nothing. What does this mean? In order to have the grace of God, as the Apostle Paul says to Timothy, we must compete lawfully. That is, our striving must be lawful. And lawful striving means as God wants it, founded upon a correct faith. I cannot believe in strange and peculiar things and then say that I have a lawful faith. Since my faith is not lawful, how can my struggle be lawful? If I do not have a lawful faith, I do not have the right faith. So if we attend to these things, then we will quickly be adorned with these virtues. And then, my children, what can I say? Then we will be the joy of God and the joy of men. Like Daniel, whom both God and men delighted in. Do you know what Daniel was called? A man of desires. That is, one who was a desirable man, a beloved man. Worthy of love. God loved him. Nebuchadnezzar loved him. The Babylonians loved him. The Hebrews loved him. Everyone loved him. That is why he was called a man of desires. And when the angel appeared, and he appeared many times, he always addressed him not as Daniel, but as a man of desires, because he was most agreeable, because he had the adornment of all these virtues, which is something I too wish for you. A question that was raised last Sunday is the following. And pay attention, it will surprise you a little, for it shows here a deep influence of much evil that is around us. Though unfortunately, our time is short. It says, could it be that God is one, but presented himself to the peoples of the East as Buddha, as Muhammad, and so on, and to us as Jesus Christ? That is, to each people he appointed, under a different person, different laws, and those who kept them will gain eternity. And further down there is a second question. Why is it not permitted for us to read Kazantzakis? And why was his book The Last Temptation condemned? Let me tell you why we should not read him, so that we do not pick up notions. Like the first question, did you grasp it? Because when we read strange and peculiar books, it is very natural to end up with such notions. So, pay attention. I here consider this to be only a question, and nothing more. But this we have already answered, when we spoke about theosophy. But if we come to accept, and to keep accepting, that Jesus Christ can be placed in the same line as Buddha and Muhammad, and all those whom they call initiates, those who have their reasons for accepting them this way, then woe to us. Note that there is a book, an old one, and you know how old it reeks of terrible mustiness. It is from the last century. It is by Schur, and it is called The Great Initiates. There, if one reads it, he will, without difficulty, place Jesus Christ too in the same category as Buddha, Confucius, Muhammad, and I do not know who else. But this is a degradation. In order to answer, however, I want not only to give these characterizations, but to put it like this, could there ever be a God who appears each time with a different person and gives different laws in every age and to every people? And indeed, if we gather these laws and commandments together, we will see a contradiction among them. Could there ever be such a God who changes person each time and comes to humanity and says what Buddhism says, what Christianity says, what Mohammedanism says, and so on? Since these things do not agree among themselves, is it possible for them to come from only one God? Is it ever possible? My children, it is very natural for these things to be said. At a time when theosophy, from that same last century, as we said when we dealt with the relevant subject, when we spoke about theosophy, tries to make this syncretism, that is, this gathering together, in order to prove and to say that all these are products of one and the same God, so as to preserve monotheism, and moreover, to draw the people of every religion to join theosophy. That is, so that you can be like a Freemason, because the metaphysics of Freemasonry is theosophy, so that you can sit at the same table with the Buddhist and have your conscience at ease, that you can offer a common prayer together, that essentially, God is one. So whether you pray to Christ or you pray to Buddha, it is the same thing. And so I set myself at ease, I ask in this sense, can we have the salvation that Christ brings us? Can we have salvation? Impossible. And faith goes out the window. It is what we were saying earlier in the lesson on atheism, that in reality, this is atheism. If we say that God appears throughout history, always under a different face, that is 100% atheism, and let us be very careful of such positions, which unfortunately we read in books and which abound everywhere in our times. That is why I tell you that we will take up the subject of atheism, so that we may guard ourselves against all of this.